Organic Farming Research Foundation is honored to share this recording of a recent conversation we had with Mike Bronkema, farmer at Shadyside Farm. In the 2022 National Organic Research Agenda report, organic farmers expressed a common concern about the lack of information available for integrated crop and livestock systems. The report also showed that the number one source of information for organic farmers is other farmers. This interview is part of a suite of resources on crop-livestock integration that OFRF created in response to that need. These interviews, farmer profiles, downloadable resources, and more are available for free on our website at ofrf.org. These resources were created with funding from Organic Valley's Farmers Advocating for Organics program. Keep listening to hear Mike discuss the challenges and benefits of integrating crops and livestock into his production systems in Holland, Michigan. This audio has been edited from a longer, more intimate conversation between Mike and OFRF's research and education team. We hope you enjoy it. Will you start by introducing yourself and your farm and telling us a little bit about the farm?
I'm Mike Bronkema. I run and operate Shadyside Farm. It's been a certified organic farm since 2010. We run 150 acres, contiguous acres. We got two sides of the street that we run on, but it is all contiguous acres. And we rent another 20 acres that we have just taken on about 2 years ago. That's a huge learning curve, quite a different process that we're in. We've been farming here since 1992 is when we took over the farm. We took over the farm from a retiring farmer that wanted to see the land stay in farmland. The area that we're located in is in West Michigan. It's over on the West Coast, mainly between Holland and Grand Haven. And if I look east of me, we got Grand Rapids out there. Generally, Grand Rapids shows up on anybody's map. And I tell them, just go over to the lakeshore and you're pretty close right in line where I'm at.
Can you tell us a little bit about your farming history?
I'm a first-generation farmer. We can go back a little bit. My grandfather had a few sheep on his place. By the time I got to be, you know, of age to start making those decisions, he was out of it already and did not have animals anymore. My parents had a little bit of land. As a teenager, I ran a couple cows just for, you might say that I put in my own parents' freezers, but that was about as much as I did farming. But then I went into construction. That was where I grew up. So I learned how to do construction from there. When I met my wife, she actually lived across the street from where we are today. She would help this farmer out, and then I started helping there. At the time, he was a pullet grower, meaning baby chicks that were day old. He would get on the farm, and at 16 to 18 weeks, they were headed off his farm ready to go and lay eggs. He was running 24,000 at the time, and that's where we picked up the farm from him. From there, we expanded the farm. We added another 55,000 in there. But shortly thereafter, the 24,000 coop that we had actually went into retirement for a couple years.
How long have you been certified organic?
We've been certified organic since 2010. We started the process actually back years before that. Our history was we had those chickens. We had chickens on our farm. And 55,000 chickens would require us over 400 acres of spreadable acreage to manage the nutrients that were coming off in here. So our foray or our beginning into the organics market was, why don't we compost our manure? Because we have urban areas near us, we were hoping that we could sell it to the urban folks around us. And we started that in 2000. When we started that, there was not a lot of information about compost, how compost was to be used, and the different types of compost. So by 2004, I was needing more information on how to use that compost. And so I hired a consultant. That consultant actually helped me transition my ground from a conventional standpoint into an organic stuff. He led me down a path using the organics nutrients that I would need, starting with the standard stuff for a while. But as we were shifting along with him, the longer we were with him, we were able to use more of the organic listed fertilizers, and that transitioned us into what we're doing today. That did include for us compost and learning how to manage different types of compost on organic soils.
What do you consider your primary production at this point?
I really don't have one primary production. Our farm is very diversified. Like I said, we had poultry. The poultry went out of here in 2016. That was the last batch of chickens that I had. But in 2004, we introduced sheep and we started rotationally grazing them. In 2011, we added in belted Galloway cows that are certified organic. They've been out there on the fields all the time too. We're rotating between the two. And in 2010, we added in heirloom dry beans. We're growing currently 20 different varieties of heirloom dry beans. Those are edible dry beans. Besides that, then we grow small grains, heritage small grains, which would be your farro types. Einkorn and spelt is what we're growing here. The other thing that we're growing here that is unique is we're growing open pollinated corn on those same acres. All of those products that we're growing here are being direct marketed then to our consumer.
As you got started with integrating crops and livestock, which came first for you, the animals or the plants?
That's always a good question, you know, and as a chicken producer, I always love to say, which came first, the chicken or the egg? We were doing crops. It's just a matter of how we were using the crop. So yes, the livestock came in before we were producing human edible food for production.
What was your path into integrating crops and livestock? Was there a particular push to begin this practice?
The production practices that I used to get started with integrating crops with my animals was that we were looking at nutrition in the soil. We were looking at soil health. That was hardly an unknown to me in that when I started with my consultant, he says, you're making compost right now. You're basing it on the standard nutrients, N, P, and K. And he says, when you get to be using this stuff, you're actually going to start looking at it as bacteria and fungi. And how do you start putting that bacteria and fungi out there in a proper manner? So with that said, the animals were kind of brought out there to change up from the chickens, but yet still allow me to use the crops, being that I was raising sheep and cattle. The hay actually harvested more of the phosphorus that I needed to remove from my soil. So it was a way to integrate the animals into the cropland was to change my cropping system here on the farm.
Is there anything you know now that would change how you approached your first season?
I'm on a continual learning system here. So to put one thing in front of the other, it's tough to do because sometimes you hear things, you learn things at one place, and then you don't implement it for a number of years. Sometimes that takes time. It takes time to settle into a brain. You know, you're set in your old ways. You got to learn how to change those old ways up and introduce new ways. Sometimes those are the hardest things to start to understand what we're set in our paths and how do we get beyond what we're set in. So, you know, for this year, you know, looking at changes and that kind of stuff, we're trying to make sure that that soil health is as good as what it is. And when I get to study in soil health, I don't have a lot of answers. I don't have a lot of resources where I can go to start understanding the fungal and the bacteria interactions in the soil and how they benefit the plants. We've got enough information out there in today's education to show us that the bacteria and the fungi go through the root system and come up into the plants. We just don't understand how many different varieties of those things that we need in the soil and how to keep them healthy and alive.
What types of changes have you seen on the farm in terms of the crop yield, animal health, or the soil health?
So for us, soil health actually started from the animals. We first started with sheep. We ran sheep for a number of years, and all of a sudden we ran into an issue with parasites in the sheep. So how do you start controlling those parasites? We found out that the best way to control parasites in sheep naturally was to add in a different species where you couldn't host the same parasites there. So that brought in health to the animals. But as we've been studying this along, you know, how do we increase health? Don't necessarily know how it affects all these things. I can see it the quickest in my sheep because I've been dealing with them the longest. So for us, parasite control today, we still do the FMACHA testing. We do a little bit of fecal testing when we get a hard outbreak or something like that. But we've actually gotten our ewes to the point where the ewes, which are the old moms, need very little parasite control. And the lambs are still needing some, but we're not having to do 100% of the lambs. and we're not having to do it on a set schedule. We still like to check the lambs on a set schedule to make sure nobody's coming down with parasites, but we manage them on a much more relaxed system, trying to keep those parasites out. That said, those things are starting to transition into our crops out there. Like I said, we grow heirloom dry beans. Heirloom dry beans are the most susceptible to diseases out there. In doing so, we've been working very hard to keep our beans healthy because we are seed savers. You can't find heirloom beans just anywhere. So we seed save our own seed there, which means we need good, healthy stock. Same thing with the corn. We're growing open pollinated corn, which is an older corn. To grow those older corns, you have to start understanding them and their nutritional needs that are happening in the soil. When you start understanding their nutritional needs in the soil, you can actually see that corn will actually outproduce some other things. We've gone into looking at nutrient density of these crops, and we're finding our nutrient density is coming up much higher than the conventional model.
So we're speaking to you in March, early spring. Can you give us a sense of what a typical rotation looks like on your farm over the course of a year or a cycle?
So just to give you an idea what seasons look like around here, we'll start with today. It's easier just to start where I'm at. The sheep are actually inside. We're in lambing season right now where we're having baby lambs. We talk about production. My ewes are very good on grass, so we're using a lot of grass to do that. Thinking back to the last question here a little bit, the ewes are flushed using a very diversified pasture and rotated basically every 48 hours they will move pastures. Lambs actually get moved when they're separated and weaned from moms every 12 hours on pasture. So that's summer activity. Currently, the cows are out on a pasture. Belted Galloways are designed to be outside year-round. They're on one of the fields that will be rotated out of production, hay production this year, and it'll be going into the corn and beans. By having them out in the field at this time of year, they're actually taking the sod that's there and they're making the sod weaker by overgrazing it so that when it comes to taking it out in the spring, that sod will be, you know, have been weakened, be easier to take it out of that. We'll take those cattle off in there 120 days prior to harvesting the dry beans so that we meet the standards for keeping pathogens away from, you know, our human food. Come springtime, we go into doing a lot of field work. The sod ground will be lightly disced. We are organic, so we don't have the sprays in our toolbox to use out there to kill the sod. So a disc is a nice cutting tool. It doesn't do real deep tillage, but it is something that will actually take out that sod eventually. So in the spring, we actually start our tillage as soon as we can. By being as diverse as we are and having the bigger rotation that we are, gives us options how to start early. Because it gives us better water infiltration on our soils to dry our soils quicker than traditional soils. Once we get the tillage done, crop planting starts. The only way we can get that done is we'll go into corn and soybeans. I'm finding out recently that it's actually better to delay planting even our corn until the soil is proper temperature. That temperature is a huge thing, and even a little bit warmer actually gives us better germination, better stand values out there to do that. So basically, you know, we're watching soil temperatures before we start planting is a huge thing, and it can even be a little bit later because it gives us better control of weeds, you know, as we go into the season. When the corn and soybeans come off, we generally choose those grounds to go into our small grains. The bean ground basically becomes our heritage grains because those are fall planted. Beans come off soon enough that we can actually then get a little bit of soil work in and get those planted and get them started before the snow falls around here. The corn is generally harvested late. We could do a few things there, but we'd like to do a spring crop. We'll either choose oats or barley, depending on what we feel is going to be our need for supplying our animals. The ewes get a little bit of that in the barn as they're ending up their last month of gestation and a little bit postpartum to keep everybody going strongly there. So that takes us back into the, you know, the spring where we'd actually plant a spring crop out there, oats or barley, and then we'd be ready to go into the rest of the year again.
Can you walk us through the continued cycle of coming back from the grain crops into the livestock and how you transition back into grazing pasture?
So our cropping system would go pastures into the dry beans, into corn, and then into small grains. So when the small grains are harvested, which is usually in July, we take those crops off. That'll give us another month or two there where we can actually do some tillage, do some leveling, set up some natural drainage ways. We tend to use wide leveled out drains, conservation type things that are grass waterways. Then we'll fix those up when we get done with our small grains. That 2 months there allows us to level the soil, get those residues reincorporated. That's helping with the fungal activity in the soil. We'll get those things back into the soil. And then by September, we're ready then to have those fields replanted into our diverse pasture mix for the animals the coming year.
What remains your biggest challenge on the farm with the crops and the livestock?
You know, my challenges here are trying to figure out what's going to work the best for the crops. Some of the things that I'm doing here are non-conventional. So when I start talking compost, because we need something to move phosphorus here, the best way to move phosphorus and get it available to the plants is to have more fungal activity in the soil. That fungal activity comes from a high carbon compost. That does not meet industry standards. Industry standards require a 25 to 30 carbon to one nitrogen when you're making compost. When you're making a fungal compost, you want to have like about 300 carbon and one nitrogen. So your temperatures don't actually meet the practices for compost, and it actually takes about a year to actually get that fungal system going. So those are some of the things. Those are broader issues than just here. It's a matter of how does the industry start using compost and the different styles of compost out there. So as we find that fungal activity in the soil, we'll actually start moving phosphorus farther. Phosphorus on its own, the roots have to be within a 16th of an inch to get phosphorus drawn up into it. If you've got the fungal activity there, that's what I'm looking to do. That's what I'm looking to increase. You can actually get 3/4, you know, to an inch with a fungal stream out there that'll actually move that phosphorus up into your plants better.
What types of infrastructure on your farm have you changed or adapted? Or is there infrastructure that you wish you had that would make this type of production system more efficient?
Infrastructure on the farm, that's always a changing thing. One of the things we started with is we started with too many fences around the farm. It made it too small. Couldn't get equipment in to do the tillage that we needed to. So we actually ended up taking out a bunch of fences and having to reset some that we had had. So our fencing structure around here is a perimeter fence set up with 5 lines going around is going to be my new theme. Top line is setting up about 40 inches with about 6 inches in between going down. We actually keep it off the ground 16 inches so that we can actually weed whip under there really nice. 16 inches high off the ground is enough to keep cattle in. It's not enough to keep the sheep in. But with 20 acres and contiguous nice square blocks here that I'm working around, that gives me a perimeter fence that I can actually run electricity through. We've got divider fences then that can be hooked up with spring gates or string gates that we can actually transfer power from the perimeter fence into an interior 20-acre divide. We'll liven those up so that we can use either rope fence for keeping cattle in or the string fence, the electrified string fence for the cattle, or we got the electronet fence that we use from either Gallagher or Premier that we're using to rotate our lambs through. Those things are set up, moved on a daily basis throughout the summer so that we can move those animals around, spreading the manure around so that we don't end up with fertility issues, you know, in stockpiled areas. One of the other things we do not have dedicated water lines around here. Our infrastructure is trailered water. With trailering water, we do not end up with mud holes or livestock areas that where they're wearing out the pasture because we'll come back to a pasture 2 or 3 times in a summer with a group of animals. So we want to move those water areas so we don't have worn out areas in those fields. So water tanks on trailers help us, you know, get the water to where the animals are, keeping it fresh on a daily basis.
You talked about your perimeter fence and the lower wire being low enough to keep calves in, but not low enough to keep a lamb in. So Can you talk about how you contain your lambs?
So to keep sheep in, you need to use the electronet fencing is the best thing I've found. The benefits of using that is I can put it wherever I want. If I have a chance and my perimeter fence is nice and clean, I love to jump the fence and actually put it on the outside of the fence because then I don't have to weed whip underneath that side of the fence. It does dual purposes there. And sheep would love to go underneath the fence, but yet they'll graze it for me up to that electric fence and keep it clean. That's the reason why I've tended to keep it up. It just gives me an option for doing that. The nice part about using electric fence that we didn't get into and by doing the rotational grazing that we're doing here is it's kept predatory animals out of my sheep. Coyotes, I know, are around my area, but my feelings is with the rotation that we're doing, moving them every other day, your coyotes have a set path that they like to use. And by moving the fence on a daily basis, you put something in their way. So the first day they run up against it, they sniff it, they get poked, they move around it, they'll go the other way. Second day, they're still in the same boat. By the third day, I actually move the fence. They've got full access back to where they were, and they're going like, what happened? It's a way for us to control predators too here on the farm. That's a huge benefit that we're seeing here.
Are there any winter infrastructure considerations for your animals that are different than during the growing season?
My cattle are outside mainly because I never had a barn, and the type of cattle that I chose were the belted Galloways. Belted Galloways have a double hair coat. They have a guard hair on the outside with a nice warm inner soft hair on the inside. That there provides them the protection that they need to survive outside in the winter year round. Tree row windbreaks are enough for them to actually survive. We actually have them calve later in the season. We're going to calve April here so that hopefully we're done with the rainy season. But that's our biggest challenge for calves out there on pasture. Now, the sheep on the other side, we tend to do those in the barn. I had the infrastructure here. We had an old chicken coop. The chicken coop is 42 foot wide, 220 feet long. I can run 115 ewes in there, which is what I'm currently running with baby lambs out there. The reason we keep them in, I know it does not make the organics list. I'm not a fan of some of those animal rights and animal welfare things. But when you let sheep outside in the winter, the ground where their paws get into tend to turn muddy real quick. Mud in fleeces make for very poor wool quality. And we are marketing wool, so it's very beneficial for us to keep them somewhere where we control that. Straw is also an issue out there. When we're dealing with sheep, they get their fleece cut off 1 month before lambing so that the babies can find what they need to. The moms know when it's cool to keep the babies warm. If we have to do a medical procedure on them, we don't have all that extra hair to work around. So they actually get haircuts 1 month prior to having babies. So then it's very beneficial to have them inside the barn. Lambs born outside today here on our farm. We got a winter storm watch with ice coming in. Hopefully we don't have that, but it's a whole lot easier to have a dry animal, a warm animal. So lambs born inside actually are being born here in February. We have a second group that's born in April. It's just management that we're having to deal around. So, you know, if you could change anything for me, we would change some of these organic rules for animal rights.
You've mentioned the field prep that you do and leveling and how you prepare for planting. Can you talk a little bit more about the equipment that you're using, what kind of disking you're doing, the implements that you are using on the farm?
So for us, we have a whole bunch of tools in the toolbox. We have to decide what one we need to use, proper times, when and where. We do have a turnover plow. We try and use that as least as we have to. It just does too much damage to the soil, bringing up deeper weeds that we've had buried for a number of years. So we don't like to use it. But if we'd have a wet spring, it's available for use. The preferred method that we'd have around here is we have a big, heavy offset disc that I can just pull with my tractors. We're running a 125 horse tractor here with a 15 foot offset disc. It has 22 inch blades on it. We set the depth where we try and start at about 4 or 5 inches deep for the first pass, just to try and get it cut open and break those things down. And then as we progress throughout the season, we actually try and move up in the soil profile so we're not going as deep, bringing up new weeds. From there, we have field cultivators. The field cultivator, we have multiple points that we can put on here, from a little straight shanked 1.5 to 2 inch wide to, you know, shovels that are 7 inches wide. depending on what the year looks like, what the soil conditions are, we'll change those points out. We do have a small finished disc. We can do the same thing with that. It's got a smaller footprint. It's got a smaller spacing between the discs, being better able to utilize less depth, but actually do a better job of cutting those weeds in the root systems down so that they go away from us, but yet still leaving that organic matter in the soil available for our plants to use for water control.
And can you talk about the harvesting and termination equipment that you're using as well?
When you're doing dry beans, there's multiple ways of doing them. We're still in the old school, being that we have the old beans. So we have to go in through and we pull those beans. The puller that we actually use has 3-foot knives on it that are running on about a 15-degree angle to the row. So they literally are skimming just underneath the surface. They'll actually cut weeds off so that we can harvest those beans in a cleaner manner, but it also does a nice job of weed control. From there, they're windrowed. That means all the things that were pulled out with a puller actually get shooken off, and weeds actually die when they don't have it, their roots in the ground anymore. So that does a really good job there. The corn does a really nice job too, because when corn gets taller, and using an open pollinated corn tends to be taller than your conventional corn, it does a better job of shading the ground. Then when we get to harvest in the fall, when we leave that out there, that leaves us with a mat. That mat then tends to discourage weeds from regrowing because they can't get through that matter that we left on the surface. Same thing, you know, even with our small grains, you know, we worry about weeds coming through. With our diversity of our pasture, we don't worry so much about that, but yet we still have a preferred set of greens that we want to use for those animals to eat that help with parasite control. So it's important for us, you know, when the small grains come off, that we do that tillage, and that helps keep those weeds at bay so that we eliminate them from later on.
What is the labor pool on your farm? Who is farming with you?
Labor? Who's got labor? We happen to be a small family farm. I have to laugh at it. It is me running the farm. I've got to make all the day-to-day decisions running from here, there, and everywhere. I do have a little bit of help. My parents are still around. They were not farmers, but they're here in the summer. They go south in the winter, so they enjoy the warm weather. They come back in the summer, and they're more than willing to help. Both of my parents and my in-laws are still here. Both of them are now 80 years of age plus, but they're willing to do things on the farm. My father will do weed whipping around the fence. He only goes through one tank a day, but it's enough that he can get around the farm in a reasonable amount of time. So he's managing that for me. So I have a little bit of help there. The other help I have is my wife helps me occasionally. She generally has taken over the lamb duties. They're moved every 12 hours. So it's a fair amount of fence moving, but it's a little bit different style than what I'm doing because I got a broader, bigger area that I can actually leave the ewes in because they're there longer. The lambs are in a smaller area, but yet move more often. So it's a matter of how you set those fences to arrange for those things. So she puts in probably 2 hours every day. For me, I'm the one doing the rest of it. I got to move the sheep. I got to move the cows. That's requiring probably 2+ hours every day. And then in the spring when you're starting and you got to do your cultivation, you know, to keep weeds out of the dry beans and that kind of stuff, that's what's taking up the rest of my days. It gives me something to do.
What is your pasture planting mix that you're using?
The pasture planting mixes we use, we've done multiple different things. The reason I've gone to the mix I've used is doing a little bit of watching what the animals were eating. And probably about 5-6+ years ago, they ran into a spot where there was an infestation of milkweed out there. And I kind of like milkweed because I like to see the monarch butterflies out there. But all of a sudden, when they hit that spot, they actually were stripping those plants of all the leaves. And I had to ask the question, why are they stripping the plants of those leaves? Come to find out, it was a way that they were paying attention to their bodies, and their bodies needed some way to have parasite control. And there's a toxoid in there that'll actually take out or reduce the parasite load on them. So that was the reason they were going after them. So I started looking at where I could find those same things in some planting mixtures that I could use for my lambs to graze on. So we went from using very traditional grass and alfalfa. We added in birdsfoot trefoil, which has one of those tannins in it. We added in clover into that mix. So you have now alfalfa, birdsfoot trefoil, and the clovers, white and red. So we have four different varieties of legumes in there, which are putting nutrition back into the soil so that we can use that for our corn ground and our bean ground, harvesting those things. But then we still needed the grass in there. So we've gone away from the tall fescues. We've gone more to a meadow fescue. We use a little bit of timothy in there. We also use some annual ryegrass in there, or perennial ryegrass, I should say, like an Italian ryegrass. That makes up the grasses, so we added in three grasses. The other things that we've added into there in the last number of years are chicory and plantain, which are two more of those things that have those toxoids in them for reducing parasite loads. So it's a 10-way mix that we're using to plant pastures. The issues that I'm having to work around here is I need a little bit of hay ground. When you need hay for the animals in the fall, the fields that have the chicory and the plantain in them, they're kind of hard to harvest and manage for hay. So we've been having to go back to a little bit more grassy pastures because we rotate through our hay fields for pastures in late summer. We've had to put a few grass ones in, but we do appreciate the diversified mix, even in our hays.
How long does land stay in pasture in your rotation?
Pastures, once they're put in, they'll probably be in for about 4 or 5 years, depending on, you know, what it is, where it is, relationship to the farm. Hate to see it. Some of my ones that are closer to the buildings get rotated out quicker than what they'd like. But the rotation, you know, if I had my way, I would love to have them in 5 years plus.
Can you talk about how you manage food safety on the farm? What are the main issues that you deal with?
So the rules for food safety in that requires us to think ahead or backwards, whichever way you prefer to think. You have to know that you need 120 days prior to, you know, manure or compost applications or animals being on those fields prior to harvest to manage those things. You know, it just requires you to think ahead. And for us in our pastures, that's pre-thought out. Like I said, the cows are going to be coming off. We just have to make sure we have them off by the beginning of May, ready to go on to the next pasture. So we move our animals off in May. Harvest doesn't happen until mid-September, which gets us in far enough into that season where we're beyond our 120 days. So it's always a thoughtful process. It's a good thing to get into those thought processes. You know, how are we going to manage those things?
Are there any key resources that you have used in learning about crop livestock integration, or any resources that you would recommend to others?
So recommendations for other people, you know, to get into any of these processes, you know, either integrating livestock or even going into organics. My recommendation is to stay one step every year and try something different using those organic methods. And sometimes you got to take two steps, you know, just to keep one step going. The longer I've been doing this, I see that it's a big ball that I've got rolling around here. Things are changing quicker than what I can imagine anymore. It is a pleasure to watch the bacteria and the fungi actually working out in the soil. When I started my sheep grazing the first few years that we were on pasture, those little green waterways that I had out there, the only place that had green pasture some years was just that waterway area. Today, we go through a drought and those areas are getting larger. I can hardly tell where those waterways are on the farm anymore because that biology is actually there supplying us with the water that we need for the crops so that they get their nutrition out of them. It's been a fun thing to see that going. So take a step. You're going to make mistakes. I've made plenty of mistakes, but I have the diversity. I encourage diversity because that's going to buffer some of those mistakes that you make on one area. Hopefully you can manage it in another area. The strength of the farm, the integration of animals in here requires us to continually take different steps, you know, so that you're moving forward all the time.
Have you ever used any type of USDA funding support, either through the NRCS or SARE, to help support the farm operation?
Back in 2000, we actually used the EQIP fund. We actually used that to put our composting system in. That started us, you know, on that track. It helped with some roadways. It helped put other things in. 5 years ago, we actually had a CSP grant, a Conservation Stewardship Program grant. With that grant, we ended up adding in another pollinator strip or pollinator habitat area. We're finding that is a huge place to help us with our insect population here. It's reducing aphids out in the bean fields. Even though it's not right next door, it's actually helping us because we're seeing those predatory insects with a place to go. They've helped us with fencing from waterways. We've used that same funding to put in grasslands. With our rotation in the 4 or 5 years that they're in pasture, that's considered a grassland to them. Even though, you know, I call it a pasture, they call it grasslands. It's a matter of figuring out the terminology that they want to use and using it to your advantage. Currently, my CSP is expiring this year, so we're going to be looking ahead to that, seeing what other practices we can put in here. Back when we did some of those things, we put in grass waterways, we put in riparian strips, wind erosion strips, our pollinator areas, fencing. Those things are all included here.
How do you deal with problems that arise on the farm? Where do you turn to for advice or support when you are dealing with an issue?
For where I'm at, and I've looked at the USDA organics pages, they have a directory out there who's certified organic in your area. I don't have anybody else that's doing what I'm doing in my area. The closest I have is I have a rotational dairy guy. Him and I get along really well. I have discussions with him. He's generally coming back to me asking me questions, but I try and gather a little bit of information from him too all the time. So where else do I get my information from? Podcasts are a great resource. Acres Magazine has introduced me to a number of good people that I can resource for different things. Generally, you can get that information listening to some of those podcasts out there. One of the other favorite things I've done, I like to talk to people directly. We are part of the Real Organic Project, which is an add-on label that we add to our organics label. They have an inspector that comes out here, but I've also reached out to them. I've reached out to Rodale in the same way at times because they have an assistance program that they have out there and asked both of them for resource people who I can go to outside of my normal area, who they can point me to that we can have those discussions with of what's going on. So I've called, I've asked about parasites in sheep. How do I control parasites in sheep? And when you're raising sheep, which are considered a minor species, your resources that are out there that you can reach out to are very slim and far and few between. We can look at the USDA and try and get some information out of there, but I don't see any producers out there or what do you want to say, USDA people that are actually growing sheep themselves or doing any research on sheep. So you're kind of, you know, on your own. So we reach out to those other people through Real Organics Projects, through Rodale to get information, get other producers, you know, try and contact those things together.
Are there any other benefits or considerations about crop livestock integration on your farm that you would like to share?
I consider my farm with the way that we're pasturing animals to be a long-term cover crop versus the short-term cover cropping system. Pastures are those long-term cover crops. You're actually producing more enzymes that are coming through those grasses and then having that diversity puts all those enzymes back into the soil, creating a bigger soil carbon bank. We've actually looked at those numbers. We've kept those numbers in mind. Our organic matters have gone up probably 1.5 points since we quit conventional farming and went this way. I actually did a test last year, a tissue test on my neighbor's field with a managing soil test thereafter. My neighbor actually had more organic matter than what I did by 2 points, 0.2. But when you actually started looking at the crop, we looked at it from above with the One Soil app, which allows you to do an infrared look at your fields. My field was in 100% in the green, no stressed corn crop. 50% of his field was stressed corn. So I saw benefits there. Those were measured benefits. When we actually looked at the nutrition in the tissue test, I had better nutrition in mind, even with some lower soil numbers for nutrition. And then it's interesting that when you get beyond that, and studies that I've been doing thereafter, we're looking at the nutrition of the crops, the corn and the small grains. We've actually seen, you know, the corn is probably running about 40% more nutritious than conventional grown corn. The wheat, when I say wheat, I'm going to go to einkorn and spelt. Those things we're finding we have about double the protein there than what you do in conventional wheat. So this whole system is actually becoming a very beneficial system, providing the nutrition for the animals that's unseen unless you start studying those things. That's a deeper dive than what a lot of people have gotten into.
Thank you so much, Mike, for sharing your story and your farm and your experience with us and with other farmers. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate what you guys are doing. You know, keep up the good work, you know, keep putting out little tidbits for everybody. It's very helpful.
Farif would like to thank Mike Bronkema and Shady Side Farm for sharing their story. This interview was created with funding from Organic Valley's Farmers Advocating for Organics program. We thank them and other funders for their ongoing support. Be sure to visit our website to explore the other resources on integrated crop livestock systems at ofrf.org/crop-livestock-integration. And thank you for listening.